Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we are very blessed to have with us, and honored to have with us, Bishop Thomas John Papraki. He is the Bishop of the Diocese of Springfield, Illinois, and he is here to talk with us about many things. Welcome to the show, Your Excellency.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Your Excellency, your home state senator, Dick Durbin, is very much in the news right now because of an award that he is receiving. And this award is a Lifetime Achievement Award. It is causing quite a bit of confusion for Catholics right now because he is a man who has a lifetime of dedication in his political office to advocating for and supporting abortion in all stages. This award that's being given out by the Archdiocese of Chicago very much violates its own stated policy, which I thought I would read briefly here, which says that any Catholic entity subject to the authority of the Archbishop of Chicago and any boards, fundraising committees affiliated with them shall not give awards or honors or host presentations, speaking opportunities, or appearances by individuals or organizations whose public position is in opposition to the fundamental moral principles of the Catholic Church. So, Bishop, could you kindly give some clarity to us and to the faithful on this issue?
Yes. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I communicate privately with Cardinal Supich about this. When I first heard the news, I heard about it through the media last Friday, and so I emailed him on Friday morning, got a response Friday afternoon, and to which I replied Friday night. So we had some exchange on this, and I asked him, please reconsider this, that this is contrary not only to the policy that you just read, but it's also contrary to the norms of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. So we adopted a policy nationally back in 2004 in our statement on Catholics and political life, which says the Catholic community and Catholic institutions should not honor those who act in defiance of our fundamental moral principles. They should not be given awards, honors, or platforms which would suggest support for their actions. So he basically made clear that he was going to go ahead with this giving the Lifetime Achievement Award to Senator Durbin. So I felt, and I told him, I said I would have to say something publicly if this went forward, because Senator Durbin maintains his home here in Springfield, and in that regard, I'm the bishop of his home diocese. And so I did make some public statements about this, and again, I'm calling for the Archdiocese of Chicago to rescind giving this award, because it's contrary to policy to be awarding someone and honoring someone who's been so consistently pro-abortion.
My understanding is that when you were the chancellor of the Archdiocese of Chicago, you were actually involved in the writing of the policy, which appears to be being violated. Did you write that because this had been an issue in the past in the Archdiocese of Chicago?
Well, I was chancellor from 1982 to 2000, basically. And it's an issue in the policy books that we get over that 8-year period. I was working on writing a lot of policies for the Archdiocese of Chicago that relate to the Code of Canon Law, which guides the church throughout the world. And so there's norms in canon law about who should receive communion or not receive communion under circumstances when a person should not be receiving Holy Communion. And that's an issue that later came to the fore with Senator Durbin in the year 2004 here in Springfield, before I was here. But in Chicago, yes, the issue would come up from time to time, but it precedes anything that had to do with Senator Durbin. So what I was referring to in 2004 was when the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops issued that policy that I just read to you, and his pastor at the time here in Springfield at Blessed Sacrament Parish was then Monsignor Kevin Vann, who is now Bishop Kevin Vann of Orange, California. And his pastor then, Monsignor Vann, told Senator Durbin that he should not be receiving Holy Communion because of his consistent pro-abortion stand. And so that goes back to 2004. My predecessor was the bishop at the time, Bishop George Lucas, who is now Archbishop Emeritus of Omaha. So when I came in 2010, I was appointed bishop here. That was something I inherited. And so when people ask me about that, because again, he's been very obstinate and persistent in promoting abortion rights, people ask me about that. I said, well, he has not been allowed to receive communion here in this diocese since 2004. So I said his position hasn't changed, so there's no reason for me to change that decision. And so that has continued here to this day. And it's my understanding that he did not go to communion here in this diocese, but he does in a parish in the Archdiocese of Chicago.
My understanding is the award is being given to him for his work on immigration. But you explain in an article that you recently wrote for First Things that a policymaker's work cannot be treated in isolation of their position on all of these important issues. Can you explain a little bit more to people who truly are confused why it's still not acceptable just because he's done good work on immigration to give an award to someone who's also in a different part of his political work advocated for abortion?
Yes, well, for one thing, the award is being called a Lifetime Achievement Award. So that is implying that it's not just on the immigration issue. It's looking at that the whole sum total of the things that he's done in his career in government and in politics. And in that regard, that's even more the reason that it's not appropriate, because of his persistent stand promoting abortion. And in that regard, I think it's very important to call to mind the consistent ethic of life that was very prominent in the teaching of the late Joseph Cardinal Bernardine, who was the Archbishop of Chicago. He's the one that appointed me to be Chancellor of the Archdiocese of Chicago. And in 1992, I served as a chancellor very faithfully until he died. And so I heard him speak quite frequently on the consistent ethic. And there's an interview that was published in the National Catholic Register in 1988, in which Cardinal Bernardine was asked about the consistent ethic, especially with regard to candidates for office and who promote abortion. And so the very first question in that interview, Cardinal Bernardine was asked if Catholic voters should disqualify candidates who don't support a human life amendment. And Cardinal Bernardine answered, well, certainly, that's what the consistent life ethic is all about. So he's very clear on that. And then later in the same interview, Cardinal Bernardine said, and I quote, I know that some people on the left, if I may use that label, have used the consistent ethic to give the impression that the abortion issue is not all that important anymore, that you should be against abortion in a general way, but that there are more important issues. So don't hold anybody's feet to the fire on abortion. That's a misuse of the consistent ethic, and I deplore it. End of quote. So it's a very strong statement, and saying that you should not ignore abortion. And when you're citing the consistent ethic of life, I mean, to do that would be, I'd make the comparison, it'd be like saying, well, someone's a good Catholic because he or she follows 9 out of the 10 commandments, except for that one, the fifth commandment about thou shalt not kill. But 9 out of 10, so that's not bad. So that person is a good Catholic. And I think that's a pretty obvious example of how, you know, that kind of thinking just doesn't work.
Bishop Paprocki, you also said in that same First Things article, quote, and I quote you, because this decision threatens to scandalize the faithful and injure the bonds of ecclesial communion, it should be reversed. Explain to us what you meant by that.
Yes, I think it's very important to understand both the, what you may say, the popular meaning and the technical meaning of the word scandal. I think when a lot of times when we hear the word scandal, we think of something that's shocking. And it is scandalous in that regard. In fact, I start my statement by saying I was shocked to hear the news that the Archdiocese was giving this Lifetime Achievement Award to Senator Durbin. But in a more technical sense, scandal refers to actions that will lead other people, wrongful actions that will lead other people to think that it's okay to do this. And in that regard, this is scandalous because it basically gives the message to other Catholic politicians and everyone in the sense that you can be a good Catholic, you can disagree with the church on matters of abortion, but that's a minor matter. It doesn't really matter. And so I think that will give a lot of politicians the ammunition to think, well, it's okay if I'm pro-abortion because, well, look, Senator Durbin's getting an award from the Catholic Church, so it must be okay. And in that regard, it is pretty scandalous.
This is coming at an interesting time because we have a new Holy Father, and unity is something he's very much stressed. It's in his crest. It was mentioned multiple times in his first words out on the loggia. And there's absolutely no question that this award is causing disunity. It's inflaming tensions and divisions. And so I think another question a lot of Catholics are asking is, with a new pope, and I'm asking this because I noticed that in the defense of the award, there was a discussion about dialogue. And it seems like sometimes we're conflating dialogue with, especially in this case, outright endorsement. So I guess this is a long-winded question, but do you have any thoughts on how do we achieve unity within the church on this issue?
Yes, so I think in that regard, some people might think, well, because I've said something to criticize this, that I'm the one that's creating disunity. And in that regard, Pope Leo, recently in a talk, he said that unity is not contrary to the truth. That truth, we have to speak the truth. And we shouldn't be silent because, well, we want to give, that would be a false sense of unity if we don't say anything. So in that regard, I think it would be a mistake to say, well, I don't want to appear to be disruptive or to show that one bishop is against another by saying something. And that would just compound the problem if all the bishops remain silent while a fellow bishop is doing something that is contrary to church teaching. I think we have an obligation to speak out in that regard. And so what's disruptive of unity is not speaking out against something that's wrong. It's the wrongful action in the first place. And the unity comes about when that wrongful action is corrected. And then we do all together in unity do what the church teaches.
So it seems to me that there are two issues here. One, which is the scandal created by giving an award to this person who has a 100% positive rating from Planned Parenthood, which means voted consistently against pro-life measures. And then the second issue is Catholics watching our hierarchy come to grips with not agreeing. And is this something that you will talk about when you have your bishops meeting, your United States Conference of Catholic Bishops? Do you think about going forward how this might foster conversation in one of your meetings?
Yes, I've already been in communication with some other bishops, and I'm pleased that Archbishop Salvatore Corleone of San Francisco issued a strong statement in support of what I've said. Bishop James Conley of Lincoln, Nebraska has also been supportive. I think other bishops will be speaking out, and I think that's important. This is not a personal issue between Bishop Aprocki and Cardinal Supic. This is a national matter because, as we said earlier, this is a policy of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. So I think it is something that we should talk about. What happens when we have a very clear policy and someone violates it? We spend a lot of time working on statements and policies and making sure that we agree on the wording and we get them all correct. And then if we do all that, we publish these policies and then they're ignored. What are the consequences for that? So I think that's something we have to talk about.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. I'd love to end on a positive note. And well, first of all, thank you for your courage and your clarity on this issue. I'm a convert, and it certainly is clarity and truth that helped bring me into the church. And I think we're seeing a trend with that nationwide. There's been a lot of buzz about an uptick in mass attendance, an uptick in people joining RCIA classes. From your perspective, do you see a sort of religious revival, maybe not a major, not with a capital R, but a growing return to faith and orthodoxy, especially among American Catholic youth?
Yes, I do. I think that I've seen that developing recently. Last year, for example, during Lent, one of the steps along the way to having the baptism, confirmation, and Eucharist for new Catholics at the Easter Vigil on Holy Saturday, the day before Easter, is what's called the Rite of Election. And last year, we had the largest group in the Rite of Election in my 15 years as bishop.
Wow.
And I've also heard that from other bishops from around the country. So there's something that's happening here. I think young people in particular are looking at a lot of the chaos in the world around them and saying that this is not right. There's something more that we're looking for. There's a deep thirst within the soul of every human being that ultimately leads us to God. And thanks be to God, I think a lot of young people. And older folks as well, perhaps some folks that have been agnostic all their lives, or maybe even atheists, are asking questions about what is the meaning of life, where do I find meaning, and are realizing that ultimately our meaning in life, our meaning for existence, and the way we live our lives is found in Jesus Christ, who was, we say, the Prince of Peace and the Blessed Mother, the Queen of Peace, that if we want a world where people can live in peace and harmony, well, then we should be followers of Jesus and live the way Jesus has asked us to live.
One last question. What was your reaction to learning that our new Holy Father is from your state?
Well, I was, first of all, surprised. I wasn't expecting that. And also, many people have asked me if I know him. We have met in passing in the past, but although we're both from the south side of Chicago, we took very different paths. So he entered the Augustinian community and went to their high school seminary in Michigan, and I entered the Archdiocese of Chicago High School Seminary in Chicago. And then as a priest, he went to South America and served in Peru as a priest and as a bishop, while I served mainly in the Archdiocese of Chicago. So I am looking forward at some point as the meeting. Have a meeting Bishop and Pope together and have a conversation with him. But I'm just very happy to see the election of Pope Leo, and I wish him all the best and keep him in our prayers too for blessings on his ministry with our Holy Father.
Absolutely. Well, Bishop Paprocki, we're so incredibly grateful for you, for your commitment to the sanctity of human life in a culture that does not appreciate it, for your courage and commitment to the truth, and for your service to the church. So we thank you so much for joining us today. And to learn more about Bishop Thomas John Paprocki of the Diocese of Springfield, please visit dio.org. And to read His Excellency's latest article on the award, please visit firstthings.com. And to learn more about us, please visit thecatholicassociation.org to follow everything we do in radio, TV, print, online, in our local communities. Your Excellency, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. God bless you.
Thank you. Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm Betsy Fentress, and we have with us today Mary Kate Zander, who is president of Illinois Right to Life. And Mary Kate, we've all been reacting to this once again Chicago-centric Catholic news. We had the positive, wonderful news about a pope from Chicago, but this is a really disappointing turn of events with the awarding by the Archdiocese of Chicago a Lifetime Achievement Award for Senator Dick Durbin. How is the Illinois Right to Life movement responding to this announcement?
Yeah, I thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. You know, this was obviously a major shock to us to hear this news. It is not new information that Senator Durbin has opposed pro-life principles over the past, 20, 30 years now of his career. And we're not just talking middle of the road, or I'm sorry, we're not even talking extreme pro-life, banning abortion. We're talking he voted against the partial birth abortion ban in Washington. So this is an individual who has just he has objectively set himself apart from our Catholic pro-life values, and yet he himself is a professed Catholic. So this is a very concerning issue for us, for sure. Absolutely.
So, how do you respond, and what is your take going to be? Are you having any kind of protests? Are you writing a doing a letter writing, an emailing campaign? How are you going forward to, lead with love as a fellow Catholic, but to clearly admonish Senator Durbin for his position?
I'll walk you through our process with this. Our very first step was to actually reach out to the Cardinal's office directly and ask we asked to have a conversation about this. We were not granted that conversation, and from there we felt it's our responsibility as a pro-life organization in the state, a pro-life leader in the state, to take this to the public, to make this known to the public that this award was being presented. So that's what we did. So we put a statement out to the media, out to the public. We have had just a sweeping response from pro-life Catholics across the state. So many people have called the Archdiocese. So many people have reached out to us, have reached out to the Cardinal, have also reached out to St. Ignatius College Prep, which is the venue for this event. So they've received a lot of communications on this topic as well. And then, once we saw that the Cardinal was not taking fast steps to remedy the situation, we decided, okay, we are going to come to the event and host a peaceful protest to continue to communicate this message that we do not support this choice. And our concern is, I mean, obviously the whole thing is concerning. I think what really stings for us is the added piece of this award is coming from the Office of Human Dignity in the Archdiocese. And that's one of the pieces here that for us just really feels like salt in the wound that we are, okay, great, let's acknowledge immigration, social justice, what needs to be done to support migrants in our country. But holy smokes, we cannot forgive the pun, but we cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater on this. We cannot ignore the evil action that Senator Durbin has taken when it comes to the issue of abortion in Washington. So that's really the steps that we've taken. So now we do intend to protest this event.
Do you work with the Archdiocese from time to time on pro-life initiatives?
Oh, absolutely. We have worked very closely with their office over many, many years. We work very closely with the Catholic Conference. The executive director of the State Catholic Conference is a deeply pro-life man, and he's a very good friend of our organization. We've always worked very closely with the Respect Life office. They have seen a change in leadership recently, and I do not know how these decisions were made. I don't know the new director of that office, so I certainly don't want to put all of this on him, but I do think that they're were clearly some questions at, being generous, there were clearly some questions that weren't asked when they chose Senator Durbin to present this award. So that's really what we're hoping to bring awareness to, even, just for their office, that did you know that this is the individual that was chosen for this award? So that's very important to us.
So my understanding is that not only is Senator Durbin a practicing Catholic, but that he actually in his political career has flipped his allegiance to the pro-life movement. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And I think this point you raise is one of the things that is particularly harmful to us as a pro-life movement in the state of Illinois. We have just experienced, frankly, a lot of betrayals by some of our conservative Catholic politicians, or, in quotes, conservative Catholic politicians over the years. Senator Durbin is one of the politicians who, when he began his political career, was a self-professed pro-life person. And then he very publicly cast those pro-life convictions aside when he decided to run for the US Senate. So this is not, he can't feign ignorance on this. He knows what the abortion issue, what this political issue is all about, and he has still made the choice to align himself with people in Washington, people in Springfield, who oppose life for the mo our most vulnerable. I mean, how can we possibly honor someone with a lifetime achievement award when in their lifetime they have so explicitly cast aside the life issue, So that's really harmful to us, and it's one of the reasons why we have pursued this issue so strongly is we need, I mean, my gosh, our state has a national reputation for corruption and bad politics. We need good conservative Catholic people in this state who are willing to stand up for life. And and we need to hold those accountable when they don't. So that's where we're at for sure.
Well, Mary Kate Zander, thank you so much for joining us. And to learn more about Mary Kate and the Illinois Right to Life movement, please visit IllinoisRightToLife.org. And to learn more about us, please visit theCatholicAssociation.org and follow everything we do, radio, TV, print, and social media. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. And we'd love for you to join us in our continuing Catholic conversations. Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm Betsy Fentress, and I'm delighted to have back with us today a voice known to many, Gia Chacon, who has really spearheaded a movement to protect persecuted Christians around the world. It's called March for Martyrs, and thank you for taking time to join us today, Gia.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for giving a platform to the plight of persecuted Christians around the world.
So you're the founder for the March for Martyrs and the leading voice for really persecuted Christians worldwide, and you've worked extensively on the ground and across the Middle East, advocating for religious freedom and human dignity, and providing direct support for communities suffering for their faith. Can you tell us what inspired you to start your organization?
Yes. So I actually have my grandmother to thank. My grandmother has been working in international crisis relief for over 40 years. I love sharing this. It's so incredible. She was actually a co-worker of the Missionaries of Charity with Mother Teresa.
Wow.
And it was really inspired by, in part, by Mother Teresa's lifting up of human dignity and serving the most vulnerable and the most oppressed that inspired my grandmother's work. So inspired by her and her life, I grew up always talking to her and listening to her stories of her travels around the world, including with the persecuted church. She actually smuggled Bibles into communist China with an organization called Open Doors USA in the 80s, if you can believe it. And I began traveling with her in 2017. And a lot of the work that she was doing at the time was to the persecuted church. And specifically, she was working at that time extensively with Iraqi and Syrian refugees who had suffered directly under ISIS. So my exposure to the persecuted church began in Egypt. And when I heard the stories of what Christians were suffering. And it wasn't just the older generations that were so on fire for their faith and willing to lay down their life, but it was people my age and even younger, who had this radical faith, willing to put their life on the line, and many in their community had been martyred. That started my heart for the persecuted. And then in 2018, I had the opportunity to work with my grandmother's organization with Iraqi and Syrian refugees, and hearing those stories of Christians who suffered directly under ISIS, I immediately knew when I sat with those Christians that this is what I want my life to be dedicated to serving these Christians and to raising awareness. Because as I began working with the persecuted Christians and telling their stories, I realized that so many in the West had no idea that it was happening at all, let alone the scale of persecution. So in December 2019, I founded the March for the Martyrs.
That's really an amazing story. You just recently pointed out in a now viral social media post real threats that artificial communication and intelligence poses on religious freedom. Tell us about that post and it's particularly the responses that you have received to it.
Yeah, so I really have been using my platform to talk about these issues and to raise awareness. So through my Instagram, Twitter, and then our organization's Instagram and Twitter, we reach over 2 million individual accounts monthly. So we are always sharing statistics and stories from the persecuted church. But one facet of persecution that is really not talked about enough, but is probably the most sinister and dangerous upcoming threat to the persecuted church is the future of AI and how it is already beginning to be used to persecute Christians. So when we shared what is really going on, which I know we will get into, the response was, first of all, people were so glad that their eyes were opened to the reality of how these technologies can be used. But again, so many people were unaware that that AI technology was being weaponized against the church.
Well, there's kind of multifacets to this that I understand you going into. One is what happens when people use computers or their phones and type in certain words. And then the other facet is cameras. Let's first talk about the cameras that are being placed near houses of worship and the way they can destroy people's lives and freedom.
Absolutely. So China is the number one offender of utilizing AI and tracking facial recognition to persecute Christians. And how they are doing this is, as you said, they are putting cameras outside of churches, inside of churches, and they are monitoring everything that's being said online. So what this means is if you are a Christian and you are attending church, they are tracking you. They're placing which church you're going to, what is being said inside that church. If you are a pastor or a priest, everything that you preach has to be approved by the Chinese Communist Party. And not only are they using the cameras to track who's going in and out, but they're also listening. What is being said? What is being talked about? And this surveillance absolutely extends online. So there was one instance in particular that really sheds light on how extensive the online tracking is for the Chinese Communist Party against Christians. And there was a group of evangelical Christians who were typing in a WeChat group chat, which is China's social media platform. And when they were typing in Christ, it was flagged as explicit content in the same way that adult content would be flagged or violence. So, in order to be able to type in the word Christ, let's say, they actually had to change some of the letters, for example, putting an exclamation point in place of the I in the word Christ. So, not only is it being censored when they type it and being flagged as explicit content, China is also tracking who is typing in these words. What group chats are you affiliated with? What is being said inside of the group chats? Is it just talking about Christianity? Is it the Chinese approved version of Christianity? Because in the last couple of years, we actually had the Chinese Communist Party dictate now even what is allowed to be written about in the Bible. And in some provinces of China, they actually changed the stories of the gospel to align with a communist agenda. So in doing
Wow.
this, yes, in doing this, what they are doing is they're not just monitoring it, but they're giving Christians a social credit score. And if you get too many dings on your social credit score, or let's say you go into the red zone category of things that are against the communist regime, that can mean that you're imprisoned. It can mean that your water will be shut off, your electricity will be shut off. We've had reports of authorities coming into homes and even removing crosses inside Christian homes. So it's very dangerous. And another thing that's happening is China is actually exporting these AI capabilities to other countries.
I want to point out that a lot of this is rendered so beautifully in this piece that you have in the National Catholic Register. Here's how AI is being used to persecute Christians. And what's even worse, besides just typing the word in Christ, that it was Thomas A. Kempis's book, The Imitation of Christ, that someone was trying to recommend, which flagged these people's, the Chinese attention. I also wanted to talk about this very sophisticated platform, Integrated Joint Operations System, which aggregates biometric data, travel history, and communications. That sounds really scary.
It is, yes. And they basically, the way that you can begin to understand it is that China is always listening and they're always watching. What are you doing? Where are you going? And what are you talking about? And again, they are monitoring whether or not you are aligning yourself with the Chinese Communist Party's approved version of Christianity. And we have already seen that there are hundreds of Christians who are being imprisoned, who are going to prison and then never being heard from again by their families. And it's very dangerous, and we're seeing that it's only going to continue to get worse.
I met a young man recently who was from China, and he told me the story that when he was in college in China, that the police would come and bust up Bible studies, and that his father was a member of the Communist Party, and his father said his father basically disowned him for being a Christian. And this man, it's a beautiful story of how someone had been holding a sign that said Jesus saves or something, and this boy went to his teacher and said, "What does that mean?" And he had never heard the word Jesus. But to have somebody in my kitchen telling me that story just really resonated with the fear and intimidation that these people are facing every single day.
Absolutely. I think in America, it's, and in the West in general, it's hard for us to wrap our heads around these restrictions on religious freedom, and also to differentiate, okay, well, but China allows churches. It's actually Christianity is growing in China, and it's on track to be the largest, quote unquote, Christian country in the world. So the difference is that China wants to use religion as a means to control their people. So any version of Christianity and really the true gospel and the true versions of Christianity are seen as a threat to power. So anyone who is outside of the approved versions is seen as a threat to their power. But the Chinese church and the stories that come out from the underground church in China are unbelievably inspiring. And what happens in these countries, believe it or not, and why Christianity is spreading so rapidly in these countries is because to be a true Christian, to say, I am going to follow the gospel, to give your life to Christ, means that you have to be willing to sacrifice, to risk your life, to risk going to prison. So it really, when you are willing to take those risks, it means that you are willing to live a different way and to know that your whole life is dedicated to Christ versus these other things in the world that we get caught up in so often in the West.
Right. And do you actually go to China, or are you a persona non grata there?
I have not been to China at this time. I do not have plans to go to China, unfortunately, but I have a lot of connections on the ground, and I am constantly in touch with people who are sending us stories of their families and what's going on. So actually, I have one friend in particular whose father ran a large underground church in China, and he's been imprisoned now for 13 years because he refused to bend his church to the, false gospel that the Chinese Communist Party wanted him to adhere to.
Have you followed the story of Jimmy Lai's and his imprisonment in Hong Kong and his trial?
Absolutely, absolutely. We follow it closely and we pray. Unfortunately, what we have seen in Hong Kong has been devastating, and we also follow very closely the what's happening with Cardinal Zen, and we're so grateful for the courage and boldness that Cardinal Zen has to continue to advocate for specifically Catholics and freedom of religion in China and Hong Kong.
I want to turn to the rest of the world, but before I do that, I wanted to ask one final question about China and the whole oppression of the Uyghurs, and who are Muslims that are being I think they are basically concentration camps, if I'm not mistaken. And do you ever partner with organizations that are also fighting for religious freedom, but they're not necessarily Christian organizations?
Yes, we do. So we have been talking actually about the Uyghur Muslims for a number of years now because we believe that extremism is the enemy to all people of faith. So, and actually, the Uyghur Muslims are an excellent example because we first saw this AI targeting and facial recognition and tracking done by China directed at the Uyghur Muslims. And you are correct. They, at one point, there was actually over 2 million Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps in China, and they were able to, in part, execute their targeting of the Uyghur Muslims because of this AI capabilities. So I'm very proud to say that March for the Martyrs is involved in the International Religious Freedom Summit in Washington, D.C., where we are engaging with advocacy groups for Uyghur Muslims. Often we partner with other organizations who are raising awareness about anti-Semitism and what's happening around the world to Jews and other religious groups. Again, we believe in religious freedom for all people everywhere.
So you've written about Iran and explain how they're using drones and facial recognition in a particularly heinous way.
So, Iran, the persecution of Christians is different than it is in China in the sense that in China, we have the Communist Party who believes all religion is a threat to power. In Iran, we of course have a radical Muslim regime who sees Christianity not necessarily as a threat to power, perhaps some, but really Christians are seen as infidels or other. So they target Christians using drone methods and fixed cameras. Facial recognition software that is in public spaces. It's in the universities. They're tracking, especially young people. And initially, these systems were used to track modesty. So in Iran, they have what's called the modesty police, and they're looking, are the women following the Islamic dress codes? But that same infrastructure is, can be, and is being used to track Christians and underground churches and converts to Christianity. It is illegal to convert from Islam to Christianity in Iran, and spreading the gospel, trying to evangelize Muslims, is a crime punishable up to the death penalty.
Wow. So it's amazing that somebody could, you could have a drone up high, and how do they figure out who that person is?
Well, if you think about what we have in the United States, right? Okay, so, we're so comfortable with Siri. We're so comfortable with our, Face ID, with putting our pictures everywhere on social media and being tagged. So, what perhaps we're not actively thinking about is the same way that AI is being used in the United States to track our spending habits, to track the content that we're interested in, to give us the right ads, to build our algorithms, that technology is being twisted and used in a sinister way to target Christians. So, I mean, again, you have your pictures in the digital world that we're living in. It's almost impossible to not have your pictures online. And so they what they do is they take the pictures and they are able to compare it to their own database and then whatever else is on social media and so on and so forth. And that's how they're able to identify you and track you. And they'll do this to your friends as well. So actually, I have friends who are Iranian here in the United States, and their family members can't even be friends with them on Facebook because the Iranian regime will track what is being said on Facebook accounts. And if you are living in Iran and you have a family member who is here in the United States and they are saying something against the Iranian regime, talking about evangelizing Muslims, saying, if they are dressed too immodestly, even in some cases, the Iranian regime will target that citizen of Iran for the actions and behavior online of their family member or friends here in the United States or anywhere else in the world.
That's just so chilling. The Pope has called for a moral architecture for AI, and tell us how we go forward.
I am very happy, and I look so much to Pope Leo for talking about artificial intelligence and the need for ethical management and framework to be centered on the human person. And really, I'm hoping to see out of the Vatican that that framework is developed. But it's up to not just the Vatican, but all of us as citizens, all of us as faithful Catholics, to implore our government and implore the Vatican to put those frameworks in place to protect human dignity and, of course, protect religious freedom around the world.
Well, thank you so much, Gia, for joining us. And to learn more about Gia Chacon and March for Martyrs, please visit marchformartyrs.com.
Thank you again.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and I'm joined by our wonderful TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. And today we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of upcoming saints whose feast days are coming down the pike. The first of which is Saint Vincent de Paul. And when I was preparing to talk with you, Monsignor, I was just trying to remind myself with a little Google search of some of the facts of his life. And it was funny because I couldn't find just a bio page because so many Saint Vincent de Paul homes for and charitable services for the poor came up. So we think of him as truly a champion for the poor. Tell us why. Why do we remember him for that?
Well, it's super important for us as Catholics always to think with the church. The old expression is in Latin, sentire cum ecclesia, and the church thinks liturgically. And this Saturday, September 27th, we have the liturgical anniversary of the death and birth into eternal life of one of the greatest saints of all time, who's made an extraordinary impact on the church and the world, Saint Vincent de Paul. He was a young kid growing on up on a farm in France. He was incredibly ambitious, but also brilliant. And he looked at the church as a career that he could really get ahead and eliminate some of his own familial shame. And so his father sold a couple of cows in order to be able to pay for him to go get a good education with some religious who were running a school. And he continued in seminary and he went far away from home. One day, his dad in his farmer's clothes walked all the way just to see his son. And Vincent de Paul was too embarrassed to come out and honor his father at all his father's sacrifice. This was the type of ambitious young kid Vincent de Paul was. Well, what happened? He eventually is ordained a priest at the shockingly young age of 19, even though you're supposed to be 25. He goes to Paris. He's trying to sort of work his way in as a super bright young priest into the social circles of Paris to try to get the money of widows when they die and everything else like this. It was all about worldly things. He went down to Marseille in order to basically try to cash in on a will of a deceased woman. And he was captured by some pirates, brought into captivity for a couple years. He had a massive conversion while he was away and eventually tried to persuade the ex-Christian wife of a Muslim man to let go of her Muslim husband and convert. And that was one of the reasons why he was able eventually to escape. But when he came back, he was a changed man. And so he wanted to use his freedom actually to do good for others rather than for himself. The first recipient were the slaves and the gallows, all the other pirates who were sort of capturing people. Vincent really worked very hard to free as many as he could and eventually used some of his connections to become the chaplain of the gallows so that he would have some care for all those who were at all in this circumstance. The second great thing that happened to him is he was falsely accused of stealing from a roommate. And he just kept saying, Dieu sait la vérité, God knows the truth. He entrusted himself over to God despite the fact that his reputation was destroyed. And after 6 months, they found the real culprit who confessed to the crime, and the roommate and everybody else was just so impressed at Vincent of Paul's faith. So what happened afterward? He started to care for the missions. He founded the Congregation for the Mission to evangelize all the farmers throughout France. Second, he recognized that one of the huge problems for the church in France was the bad formation of clergy. They didn't have seminaries, even though the Council of Trent insisted upon seminaries. So he used his political connection to say, before anybody's ordained a priest, they've got to do a 2-week retreat with me. That eventually grew into 2 years with him and his congregation for the mission, which were the first seminaries in France. And then he went to bishops and he said, one of the problems, bishops. And so they gave him the capacity to form a council because the French king would be involved in the appointment of bishops at the time, that the king wouldn't appoint without Vincent de Paul's okay. And so he had a tremendous impact. But the biggest thing for which he's known is his care for the poor. And so with Saint Louise de Marillac and many of the other women in Paris, he started to care for an incredible 60,000 people a day who were starving, in order to just be able to give them the basic loving support when they were on the outskirts of Paris society. And that led to the inspiration of people all across the globe to imitate. He wasn't the founder of the Saint Vincent de Paul Society. That came about 2 centuries after, but he was the inspiration for the Saint Vincent de Paul Society so that we would be able to make our real priority caring for those for whom Jesus died. And so that's a little bit of a snapshot. Every time we come to September 27th, we should be praying about the growth of our faith, especially to those who are being poorly formed, priests, bishops, and particularly the poor.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, but I don't want our time to end without also talking about one of my favorite saints, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, whose feast day is next Wednesday on October 1st. She's known colloquially as the Little Flower. Why?
Because she said that we don't all have to be a rose in God's garden. We know that the roses please God and what a great smell that they give off. But she said we can be a petite fleur, we can be a little flower. And if the gardener has planted us, we bring him joy too. There's a purpose that not every flower in the garden is a rose. Some are tulips, some are carnations, some are sunflowers, you name it. She was totally content to remain a little flower rather than a great rose, provided that that's what God wanted of her. And so she taught us all her little way to holiness, that we don't have to be one of these great saints written in the books, the ones who do heroic feats or through whom God works tremendous miracles of healing or exorcism. But we can please God along the way of trust and love. As a little child, entrusting ourselves to God with trust, just like a little kid does to loving parents, and then a way of love that he has filled us with love and we want to love others. She said that the way to holiness is not climbing up a high mountain. It's actually going down into the valley of humility where God meets us and then lifts us up. She's one of the great saints of all time. She's worked various stupendous miracles in my own life. I'm very happy that I share a great devotion with you. But the one thing I want to emphasize about Saint Therese, beyond what we've said, is she's a co-patroness of the missions of the church. In October, we start World Mission Month, which culminates on October 19th this year, World Mission Sunday. Why is Saint Therese, who never left her Carmel in Northwest France, a co-patron with Saint Francis Xavier of the mission? And the clear reason is because the mission of the church always begins with prayer. Jesus told us to pray to the harvest master for laborers for his harvest. And Saint Therese in her Carmel, with all her other Carmelites, were praying for the mission of the church. She adopted two young missionaries as her spiritual brothers and really prayed for them and offered her sufferings for them and for the fruitfulness of their work. And so, for those of us who have a devotion to Saint Therese, it's important that we share her great love and care for the missions and join her, who continues to pray in heaven, for Christ to be known to everybody all over the face of the earth. That's how we start the month of October.
Thank you, Monsignor. Thank you for joining us today.
Great to be with you once again, Ashley. Happy World Mission Month.
You too.